Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is a ranking member of the Democratic hierarchy in the U.S. Senate. How does he see the new D.C. landscape now that Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House? We'll find out a little bit later, after we look back at some local history that is not often discussed. You may or may not know that tens of thousands of Axis prisoners of war were held in this country during World War II. They were placed in camps in 46 states, and many thousands of them were imprisoned in this part of the country. Few, if any, know the story better than our guest, David Fiedler, the author of The Enemy Among Us, POWs in Missouri During World War II. David Fiedler joins us in studio. It's great to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Don. Absolutely.
Let's begin this with a kind of a brief overview, if you would, of what was going on. Number of camps, number of prisoners, that sort of thing.
Sure. So, you know, the United States got into World War II about 2 years or more after it had started. So our allies had already lots of prisoners of war that they had captured, and they needed some place to go with them. So the United States agreed to accept them, and they were being shipped here at a rapid rate. What that meant for Missouri was that there were 15,000 German and Italian prisoners of war, first in four large camps across the state, and then eventually they spread out and worked in much smaller farm camps and that sort of thing. The Missouri prisoners were part of a larger group in the United States that ultimately totaled 350,000 German prisoners of war across the United States, as well as 70,000 Italians. So between 400,000 and 500,000 total enemy prisoners of war here in the United States.
That's an interesting number. I was thinking this morning about that, and that's about the number of Americans who were killed in World War II, if I'm not mistaken on that.
Absolutely.
So interesting.
An enormous group of people.
Right, I mean, right. What were the camps like?
So originally, when the government agreed to take them here, to bring them to the United States and hold them, they were concerned about security first and foremost. And so the camps themselves were built on existing military bases. You would have a large installation like Fort Leonard would, and then within that, there would be the prisoner of war compound. And the prison camps themselves were really identical to the housing areas and facilities that our own troops occupied. The Geneva Convention, right, the rules that govern warfare say basically you as the host country were responsible for treating the prisoners the same as you did your own personnel, the same types of food and the same types of housing. So they were housed in large army barracks and eating in mess halls. The biggest difference, of course, would be the large barbed wire fences that surrounded them and the searchlights and the guard dogs and those kinds of things designed to keep them in.
They were also paid the equivalent sums of our GIs, were they not, for work they did?
That's right. A lot of their work, Don, took place there on those Army bases to operate not only their own prisoner of war camps, but in support of the larger military operations. You would have, you know, in a camp like Fort Leonard Wood, 5,000 German prisoners of war. So there was an immense need for their labor just to support the camp itself in laundry and barbershops and bakeries and mess halls and all those kinds of things just to run the place. Additionally, a place like Fort Leonard Wood housed any number of basic trainees, thousands of American soldiers. Camp Crowder in southwest Missouri had the Signal Corps with 40,000 American soldiers. And so the prisoners of war were also put to work in support of those American soldiers. They worked in the military, in the motor pool, in the warehouses, in the dining hall. They would be orderlies in the officers' club. They were present everywhere on these military bases. And yes, as you said, they were paid for their work, which is surprising to people. 10 cents an hour, typically, which was about what our privates, our U.S. Army privates received. And that money could be either socked away in a savings account to take back and cash out after the war in Europe to help resume life there, or also spent in camp stores on personal items for the prisoners themselves.
How well did they coexist, the Americans and the prisoners?
It was a fairly positive arrangement. Of course, there were always bumps from time to time. The problem early on is that our government did not eliminate or separate the fairly small percentage, but dyed-in-the-wool Nazis, the actual highly committed National Socialists that were aligned with Hitler. And those were ones who were They were not cooperative. They were defiant and intended to cause trouble any way they could. And so to have that presence in the camps was a difficulty for many reasons, including intimidation and threats and physical violence, in fact, against their fellow soldiers whom they considered too compliant with the United States. Once those corrosive elements were removed, the population of prisoners as a whole was much easier to get along with, and no one was ever happy, I don't think, to be a prisoner of war, but certainly many were glad to bide time and count the days till they could get back home. So that meant just cooperating, doing the work every day, and just by virtue of being together, you know, side by side and face by face and working together, a fairly easy cooperative relationship grew up over time. And, to the point that friendships existed, to be sure.
I guess it's safe to assume that they had a better deal here than our POWs in Germany, for instance, or in Europe had.
Yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. Those in particular held by the Japanese suffered greatly. In the early days of the war, it seems sometimes difficult to believe, but Germany was pretty particular about providing good treatment to our prisoners of war as well. However, as the war progressed and as conditions in Europe and in Germany in particular really fell apart, where the army was destroyed, there was no food, no medicines, civilians were on the march everywhere, the conditions plummeted as well for our servicemen held in German hands, and they suffered greatly. It was a completely different experience to be a prisoner of war here in the United States.
As we began to learn more about that, and in particular learn about what was happening to the Jewish population in Europe, did conditions change here as well, perhaps not quite so cozy relationship with the prisoners here?
There was a lot of anger, to be sure, and a lot of pressure on the government. People said, why are we putting these prisoners of war up in relative country clubs? Why are we pampering them and setting them up in these, you know, quote-unquote luxurious environments? They were still army bases, but, you know, three square meals a day and running water and soft beds was a luxury compared to what they had enjoyed. Why don't we really put the screws to these guys and make them suffer the way that they have caused others to suffer? So the government really received a lot of pressure to move in that direction. There was resistance toward that and you know, a sentiment of, you know, we need to take the high road here. And even though others have suffered at the hands of our enemies, we should not fall to that level. So the good treatment generally prevailed, although, of course, there was lots of individual incidents of expressions of disappointment, disgust, and hostility.
Many of them did farm labor, as you pointed out. What sort of fraternization was there between the prisoners and the local population? I mean, they were out and about at some point.
Oh, sure, Don. That's a great question. The government realized pretty early on that these men were not a great threat of escape or destruction or other nefarious deeds. And so there was such a labor shortage that quickly the government moved the prisoners of war from these four large camps on military bases with thousands of prisoners to suddenly literally dozens of smaller camps all across the state, much less formal, much less heavily guarded, much more opportunities for social interaction. You know, it was a camp in Chesterfield Valley where, you know, basically year-round contingent of prisoners who worked on any number of farms in the area, and they would get to know the farmer and their families. And, you know, there's plenty of people who have relayed stories of inviting the prisoners in to eat lunch, you know, a regular farmhand's lunch with the family, or children who remember the prisoners playing with them, and a pretty easy and casual relationship. Romantic relationships, of course, remained off limits and strongly forbidden. But, you know, how can you completely squash when Cupid starts firing those arrows around?
Well, what do we know about that? Whether ultimately marriages after the war, that sort of thing?
Sure. There was a, you know, romance was a dangerous thing. Yeah. And so there were people who got in trouble for that, prisoners who would express their affection through love notes and intercepted, and they would be sent away. Or, you know, instances where American women would fall in love with a prisoner. And, you know, a couple times that turned to aiding escapes, which was a traitorous act that could be a criminal offense. But, you know, there was plenty of other casual romance that didn't go anywhere, and it probably wasn't maybe headed down the altar. One of the stories that was told in Chesterfield was one of the little girls in the farm families out there had a bike that she loved to ride around. And one day she pointed out to her father that she would park her bicycle in a certain place at night, and she would come back in the morning, it would be somewhere else. Well, one of the prisoners who were there at their farm would get on this bike, of course, and go ride off at night and see a girlfriend that he had somewhere. There were no, at least in Missouri, only a handful of marriages, and none of them really, this is funny, Don, none came about as a result of direct contact during the war. One Italian gentleman wrote a farmer in Sykeston and said, "Thank you for your kind treatment while I was there. You know, I really enjoyed working with you, sir." And this guy was not a good letter writer. He didn't respond, and the daughter said, "Dad, you need to write him. Dad, you need to write him." And finally, she wrote him. And so correspondence after the war led to marriage. So indirectly, that may have been that occurred.
I only have a couple of seconds before we have a break, but when they're out and had this kind of freedom of movement, were there many escape attempts?
There was certainly opportunity for it. There were not wholesale escape attempts, although the opportunity was certainly there. There would be 100 prisoners of war working in a cornfield somewhere. One guy watching them is maybe taking a nap under a tree. The opportunity was there, but it was easier just to stay put. And really, who wanted to rush back into the war? Where were they going to escape to?
Exactly. I mean, in the middle of the country, it's a long way to Germany from here. We have to take a break. David Fiedler is our guest. He is the author of The Enemy Among Us, POWs in Missouri During World War II. Back to continue our conversation momentarily. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to our conversation with Dave Fiedler, author of The Enemy Among Us, Powers in POWs in Missouri During World War II. There we go. I'm back on track, Dave. Most of the prisoners were Germans, then Italians. No Japanese were housed in this part of the country at all, if in this country at all, were they?
That's correct, Don, and that's for a couple of reasons. As we mentioned, there were 350,000 Germans in the United States, 70,000 Italians. There were a total of 5,000 Japanese prisoners of war in the United States, so only a fraction and none here in Missouri. And that was a consequence of where we fought the Japanese and the type of warfare that took place and the fact that very few were captured. Also, one of the positive sides of the prisoner of war program was the ability to use them in the labor program. In culturally, Italians and Germans were fairly similar to the Europeans that make up, at that point at least, the predominance of folks already living here. Culturally, Japanese prisoners of war was not the labor program didn't work the same way as they did here.
Yeah, and your focus obviously is on Missouri, but I know that in Illinois there were a number of camps as well.
That's true.
Yeah, and same kind of concept and the same kind of demographic makeup, needless to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had one of our listeners had communicated with us when we were promoting this program and pointed out that apparently there was quite a distinct difference in personality between German prisoners and Italian prisoners. And as some might expect, the Italians, joie de vivre, if you will, they were kind of outgoing. Germans much less so.
Yeah, and that's a story that bore itself out time and time again. Whether it's broad cultural stereotyping or just the way that it played out in these individual instances, people reported that the Italians were fairly easygoing, and you know, they worked at a hospital in Springfield, Missouri, and the nurses talk about the Italians playing on the guitar and sitting out in the evening and singing and things like that. And you know, the camp commander at Camp Weingarten in St. Genevieve County, just south of St. Louis, said that there were 5,600 Italian prisoners of war. If a big wind came and blew the fence down at 10 o'clock, it would be 11 o'clock before the Italians realized it. And even if they took off, it would be noon. They'd be back for lunch in the mess hall. Just a pretty relaxed and easygoing attitude.
There are a lot of jokes that came out of World War II with regard to the Italian military and their fighting capabilities and desires, but we better not go into those in this program. What about the difference in treatment between officers and enlisted men? Were they housed together?
That's another great question, Don. Typically, the prisoners of war would be separated, where you would have an enlisted men's camp. The predominance of the prisoners here were enlisted men, and you would have non-commissioned officers, the senior enlisted men that would maintain order in the camps and discipline, and really the same sort of military hierarchy continued to be imposed to keep order in those camps. And the American staff would work through the chain of command in that military group to drive that. The officers themselves would typically be in separate camps, and in particular high-ranking officers would be in completely separate camps with – they would have their orderlies and their laundry would be done with them, and they didn't have to work if they didn't want to. It was certainly the military protocol did not vanish even though they were prisoners of war.
We have a listener who wants to get into the conversation. Rich is calling us from the Bevo neighborhood. Rich, come on in. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. It's just an observation. As at the outset of the conversation, we had as many Axis prisoners in the United States as there have been American casualties throughout the entire war. And here, 70 years later and 15 years after 9/11, we've got a couple of score of prisoners in Guantanamo, and it's hue and cry about the idea of imprisoning them in the continental United States. Well, there's plenty of secure prisoners to go. And that's pretty just the observation. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Rich. Any thoughts on that? No need to get into the Guantanamo. But, one of the things that does bring to my mind is the fact that there was discussion about moving some of those prisoners to the United States. There was an outcry, and people didn't want, not in my backyard kind of thing. There must have been that sort of feeling as well back in the 40s.
You know what, Don? The war was so pervasive in every aspect of everyone's life that it just influenced everything that took place. And I don't want to by any means imply that people just accepted what the government did, but I think the ordinary citizen realized that it was a unique time and certain accommodations had to be made. The other thing is this was very much of a local story. There was no 24-hour news cycle. People just didn't get in the car and drive 75 miles. It was much more of a locally focused world. And if there was no one around to work in the potato fields, or the corn was going to rot in the fields in the fall because there was no one there to bring it in, if the local agricultural co-op, the Growers Association, was able to secure the labor of 100 German prisoners of war to pick them, and the local sheriff felt fine about it and they were hadn't been dangerous anywhere else, it was not seen as a great concern. It was not going to be a standing thing, nor were they at that point perceived as being a particularly dangerous group of people.
And yet my impression is that it was all kept relatively low-key. There was not a lot of publicity. Obviously, we had a bunch of people, strangers, around the corner. Folks would know about it. But otherwise, it was not broadcast, if you will.
Right. And I don't think there was anything hidden about it. It just was yet another detail in this overarching theme of World War II, again, affecting almost every aspect of every person's life. And in researching this book, Don, I would go and look at the old newspapers, and it would say, in June, 30 prisoners of war will be here in mid-July to help bring in the soybean crop. And at least reading further in the newspapers, there was not a great pushback against that. They would come and do their work and move on. It was both, I think, trust of the government and an acceptance of the fairly unique circumstances that brought them there.
What did the prisoners do when they weren't working? What were their diversions?
Sure. And they had the opportunity to have a fair amount of entertainment. Certainly they were busy during the day, whether that was working in those large prisoner of war camps on the military bases or in the smaller branch camps across the state. But the evenings and weekends, maybe Sunday, would be free time for them. And the prisoners could stay busy with sports, arts and crafts. The larger facilities, the permanent ones on the military bases, had libraries for the prisoners where they could read books and magazines and newspapers, not only in their own language but in English as well. They would form theater groups and musical chorales and orchestras and things like that. They were pretty creative at coming up with ways to entertain themselves and others, for sure.
I'm sure the Italians led the way on that, on the music part of it.
Right.
We've only got about a minute left. Did any of them stay, decide at the end of the war they didn't want to go home?
The government was really clear all along, Don, that the prisoners would not be allowed to stay. They were needed to rebuild the European community and the civil structure. They all had to go back home for that reason. And also there was the concern of how to resettle and reemploy these hundreds of thousands of American GIs that would be coming back too. So to have an employment position taken by a prisoner of war when there would certainly be a GI there, that was not possible. A number did return as immigrants, a fairly small number. There were probably a dozen here in St. Louis researching the book. And many came back to visit the places they had been held.
And again, just a few seconds. My understanding is that those that went back were kind of utilized as spread the word about democracy and rebuild their own nations.
Sure. The positive treatment that they experienced here, another way that we promoted that was to say these are people who go back and reestablish society in Europe and have an opinion in the United States, and we want that to be good.
Dave Fiedler, it's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for telling it to us today. He is the author of The Enemy Among Us, POWs in Missouri During World War II. And this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.